In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
This season of Island Crime contains material that might be difficult to hear. Sweethearts explores themes of human trafficking, sexually exploited youth, violence, and murder. Please take care while listening. Rhonda is sitting in her grade 12 high school homeroom when her teacher delivers the news. Her classmate, her friend, Kimberly, is dead. And as if that's not horrific enough, Rhonda will soon learn that her friend has been murdered. Kim has been strangled to death, her body discovered in a hotel room. Seventeen-year-old Kimberly Gallup was killed on November 21, 1990, just a few weeks after her 17th birthday on Halloween. There's a single picture of Kim, which appears in the handful of newspaper articles written over the years. She's posing for her school photo. Kim has long brown hair. It's the late 1980s, and like all of us back then, Kim has her hair piled high on her head. She has big hoop earrings and light, glossy lips. She looks shy, almost demure, soft. And that is how a number of her friends and family describe her. Soft. I'm Laura Palmer, and this is Sweethearts, Island Crime, Season 6.
Another climb, another fall, another try, another call. You made your choice to be alone. You had the chance to change it all. Another moon, another sun. You drop your petals one by one. You shut the roses with your gun. You didn't stay, you chose to run. I'm not mad, I'm just sorry. I couldn't make you feel safe. I will give you space, don't you worry. I will learn how to dance in the rain.
Retired Victoria Detective Don Bland first raises Kimberly Gallup's unsolved murder with me. I'm researching the abduction of four-year-old Michael Dennehy. Now, I'm a veteran journalist. I've been working in news on the West Coast since the early 1990s. But this information comes as a complete shock. Detective Bland describes just how busy he and other Victoria police are in 1991, when Michael disappears. Resources are stretched thin. He tells me at the time, police in the region are working on multiple cases involving the murders of young women, teenagers. In the space of about 12 months, three teenage girls are viciously killed in Victoria. 17-year-old Kimberly Gallup, 18-year-old Sherry Lynn Smith, and 17-year-old Melissa Nicholson. But the headlines of the day seem to tell a different story.
Mom walks street looking for clues to who killed her hooker teen.
Body identified as teen hooker, victim number three.
Street corners could turn into hooker war zone.
Police seek slain hookers, polka-dotted tights.
Tough road to hoe.
For more than 30 years, the families of these girls have lived with the stigma and the shame that came with the hooker teen headlines. It's long past time for that to change.
She was a sweetheart. She fell in love with a boy and she made some mistakes and she was lured into a lifestyle, but she was a 16-year-old girl. She was someone's daughter.
Sherry, Kimberly, and Melissa were preyed on, lured with promises of love and money, and then they were killed. I believe their cases could be linked. And as I've discovered, I'm not the only one who thinks so.
So I have absolutely no doubt at all that around 1990, 1989, 90, 91, that there was a serial killer in Victoria killing street workers.
I'm beginning with Kim's story. This is Sweethearts, Episode 1, Soft. This story begins with a request from a listener.
Hi, Laura. I want to bring the case of Kimberly Gallup to your attention. Kim and I went to the same high school, Parkland Secondary, in Sydney. When she was in grade 11 and I was in grade 12, she was murdered in a hotel room in Victoria. She was 17. They called her a hooker and a prostitute in the papers, but honestly, she was just a normal girl. She didn't deserve what happened, and I think the older I get, the more it weighs on my heart.
My name is Rhonda Waterfall, and I grew up in Sydney on Vancouver Island.
Rhonda goes on to have a career in advertising. She's now a writer with a family. Rhonda lives just outside of Toronto, but to this day, she remembers her Vancouver Island high school pal, Kimberly.
I was at Parklands High School in Sydney in grade 12, and Kimberly had come there to take grade 11. So we only knew each other for a very short period of time. She was murdered in November, so she started school sometime September, of course, and was dead by November. It always stuck in my mind just how unfair it seemed.
Rhonda recalls welcoming Kimberly into her group and how quickly they become friends.
She was really bubbly. Like, she was an upbeat girl. She was happy. She loved fashion. And there was kind of a group of us girls, and she had kind of become a bit of, you know, within our little group of girls. And because a lot of us had been together since elementary school, you know, Sydney's not a big town, so everybody knows everybody. So it was like this new person, and it was really exciting. Yeah, it was just fun. It was nice to have somebody new into the crowd. Like, she just was such a lively, kind of happy girl.
Kimberly's cheery, bright disposition in high school belies a secretive other life.
Like, she didn't give off any indication of what was happening elsewhere. You know, and this is the thing about Kim. This is probably why she stays in my mind so much. She wasn't a tough girl. Like, I knew tough girls. Like, I knew girls that would, like, knock your block off in a Safeway parking lot. Like, those kinds of girls. And Kim wasn't that. She was very sweet. And she didn't give that, like, rough edge, you know, that you'd think might be there for what she had gotten into. She just didn't give off that vibe at all.
Rhonda's fun-loving friend is leading something of a double life. Kim's just a girl, 16 in those months she and Rhonda are forming their friendship. And Kim is being sex trafficked.
When she was murdered, I have the memory of knowing what she was doing outside of school, but I don't know if that's an accurate... Because I remember not being surprised, and I don't know why now. Like, I don't know if it was because I knew what she was up to, or because it wasn't out of the realm of possibility either for girls in Sydney. The only shocking thing to me was that she actually got murdered. Like, that was the shocking thing. Being in the sex trade was like, blah, whatever.
When I first hear this, it gives me pause. Surely, nice, normal high school girls getting caught up in the sex trade is an aberration, the stuff of movies and TV shows like Twin Peaks. I think about myself and my own high school friends. We were reckless, we drank too much, and we were also naive.
like she was just a normal girl. Like, I think a lot of people, when they hear, you know, prostitute strangled in a motel room, they think, though, this was some girl born in an alley, back alley, and drug issues and whatever. Like, she just had a terrible life. And so, like, obviously, this is how it should end up. But she wasn't that. She was just as normal as the rest of us. Like, she was just a normal girl.
Kimberly is not a prostitute. She is a victim of child sex abuse. And when it comes to young people who are sexually exploited, language matters. These days, we use the term sex trafficked. When you're too young to consent, that's sex trafficking. In Canada, it's against the law for anyone to purchase the sexual services of a person under the age of 18 years old, or to benefit from child prostitution. It's also illegal to encourage or incite a person under the age of 18 to participate in prostitution. Back then, the school, it would seem, isn't keen to acknowledge Kimberly's death or the fact that one of their students, a teenager in their school, has been involved in the sex trade.
I go to school one morning, and I'm in my homeroom, and the homeroom teacher says, "Hey, Kimberly was murdered."
By noon, Rhonda says it was business as usual. With zero information, she and her friends imagine the worst. Rumors swirl, while the adults around her seem to want to pretend that nothing has happened.
And then what sticks with me is that the school did nothing. Not an announcement, not a get people together to discuss this issue, which probably is what should have been done, because the girls ending up in the sex trade in Victoria was not out of the realm of possibility. It was just radio silence at the school.
The way Kim's murder is handled by the school leaves Rhonda feeling uneasy.
I felt she was swept under the carpet. She was prostitute. It just never felt like enough was put into it. And, you know, I don't think Victoria likes to talk about dead prostitutes. Kim was no different than the rest of us. You know, and to go to school and then for one day a girl to just be murdered and nobody do anything about it, it doesn't make you feel too good, like about your own existence. Like, she just was such a sweet girl. Being in Sydney, being very close to the sex trade in Victoria, like, honestly, it could have been any of us. And I know Kim was probably just, striving for something different. You know, I just know how the rest of us felt as girls on the island. Some of us were very determined to get off the island. I just feel like Kim was choosing her way to get off the island or get to something new, shiny.
I study that high school image of teenage Kimberly Gallup. She's wanting to leave this island, impatient for something new. Now frozen in time in this photograph, while her friends, like Rhonda, are hitting 50.
A long time ago now, but it's also, you know, just how somebody holds this instant with them as they age. You know, like, I'm going to be turning 50 soon. And, you know, some stuff just stays with you. All I can hope for, really, is that light is put onto her case and just that more people are made aware of what happened, who she really was. Because I just always felt like, you know, it was that, oh, she was just a prostitute. But she wasn't. Like, she was literally a girl. And there's also always that hope that it just twigs somebody's memory.
More than 30 years on, Kim's death still weighs on so many people. The first calls I make are to Kimberly's parents. I try to put myself in their shoes. It's been 33 years since Kim's murder. What must it feel like to have a reporter ring you out of the blue to talk about the very worst thing that's ever happened to you?
Good afternoon, Barb speaking.
Oh, hi, Barb. This is Laura Palmer calling.
Kim's mom is wary. She isn't sure there's any purpose to speaking with me. I leave it with her and let her know she can take all the time in the world to think about it. Kim's dad is a different story. He's a friendly guy, a talker, he tells me, and he lets me know he's happy to speak with me, that he will not rest until he knows what happened to Kimmy. That's what he calls her, Kimmy. It's been years since he had any communication with police about his daughter's case.
Please drive to highlighted route.
I arranged to meet Kimberly's father, Del Gallup, on a weekend in Victoria. I drive down the island with a plan to connect with Del early the next morning. It's a Saturday, a gorgeous, sparkling August day. Del and I are getting together at a spot where he has been coming for years. It's just west of Victoria, the Sunny Shores campsite. As I approach, I see a group of small cabins and mobile homes on a field at the water's edge. It looks like the kind of place people come to launch their boats and do some salmon fishing. There are some old wooden picnic tables and people sitting around having coffee on folding camp chairs. Del's a tall guy with longish graying hair. Today, he's dressed casually.
Well, my name is Del Gallup. I was Kimberly Gallup's father. Jeepers, I don't know really what to tell you about myself, other than I was a career mechanic, technician with automotive industry for a few years, and moved into the heavy equipment industry and spent almost 50 years in the heavy equipment industry in the oil patch.
Del is now retired, back in Victoria. And of course, it's his daughter Kimberly I've come to talk about. He shares a few memories of her as a little girl.
She loved little animals. We always had dogs, cats, rabbits. We had any pet you could imagine. And didn't care for school too much. She was always a little bit, I won't call her a rebel child, but she was busy, you know. She had too many more important things to do than she wasn't really crazy about school.
It's impossible to talk about Kimberly's early years without understanding the marriage that is the backdrop for Kim's childhood.
But it was pretty rocky, I have to tell you. It was a mess. It was a difficult separation and divorce. So there was a lot of friction between the mom and I, you know, and the kids had to feel that. You know, the kids went through, they struggled. They had some tough times.
And when Kim moves into her teenage years, she begins to rebel.
Kimmy did not really want to be at her home, and she went and stayed with my mom and dad first in Sydney. So she went to the Sydney school, and she was a little too wild for them. She didn't really want to come home. She didn't want rules. She didn't want any structure. She ran away. So she came to me for a while, but she was really, really wild. She wanted to be out fancy free and on the streets, and, you know, school wasn't her thing. And then she moved into a house on my street in Langford with some other girls.
It's around this time Del learns his teenage daughter is being exploited in the sex trade.
She had a pimp, for lack of terminology, a boyfriend, she called him. And that was when I found out that she was in Kamloops in Vancouver. They were on a circuit. These girls were doing a circuit, so.
So that must be incredibly hard for you as a dad.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
Or you can't do anything. What could you do? Go to the police and have them hold her for a night? I just tried to give her some thoughts, you know. Is this the right choice? Is this really what you want to do? You know, like, you know, this is could end in disaster, but she did not grasp that. You know, the money was easy and no rules.
Right.
No rules. Total free will, that one. So.
Del talks to me about an attempt he makes to get his daughter to step outside her world and see other possibilities for her life.
They went over to Vancouver, and I phoned around, and I finally found out where she was, and I got a hold of her and asked her if she'd like to get together and go out for dinner. I embarrassed the living heck out of her. I'm proud to say it was one of my finer moments. She showed up to go out for dinner in 4-inch spike heels, a super tight mini skirt.
Oh, dear.
and a shirt that said party nude. So I took her to one of the finest restaurants in Vancouver, and I never cracked a smile.
What's going through your mind at that point?
I just wanted to show her that there was another side to life and you don't have to do what you're doing.
Dell wants his daughter to see that there are other paths she can take. But from his perspective, she is already becoming entrenched in the lifestyle.
Yeah, they were on a circuit. They were in Calgary, Kelowna, Vancouver, Victoria. I don't know the circuit. I didn't even try to understand it. I was focused on an individual.
How's she looking? How's she seeming at that point?
She didn't seem like a stoned out old street chick, you know. She talked to me and called me daddy. No, she was a lovely young lady. Just I can't even fathom how she got into what she was doing or why. You know, it's not something she would share with me.
Did you get the sense when you were having conversations with Kimmy that, like, how aware she was of danger, or was that ever?
No, the danger part didn't seem to fizz her. You know, I said I did tell her, you know, you could end up dead. Like, this is not a good trade. This is not a good thing to be doing. But the fact that she did come to me and she was scared and wanted to get off the street for a bit. She stayed with me for maybe a week or two, but then she went back. So she was scared. Something out there scared her, but she wouldn't talk about it.
What was frightening Kim then? Did she tell anyone else? Could this be connected with her murder? Dell tries to recall the last time he saw Kimmy. His memory is a little hazy here, but he believes it was the fall of 1990. Not too long before his daughter is murdered.
She came by my house, her and some of her friends, because they were staying in a house down the street from me. And I was at the time right into racing cars and building race cars in my shop. And her and her little friends would come down and sit in the shop and talk to me while I was welding and mechanicking and
right.
And doing things. But
yeah.
But she seemed rather enthralled with the racetrack. She actually, somewhere in my repertoire of things stored, have pictures of her as a trophy girl at Western Speedway in Victoria.
Right.
She did a gig doing that. So that would probably be the last memories I have.
Sitting around,
hanging out in my garage.
You can picture it. Dell tinkering away on his cars. Kim and her friends comfortably hanging out. It's a lovely father-daughter time. Except it isn't. Not really. Kim's being sex trafficked, and those little friends are likely also in the game. I'm walking Dell through this period of time leading up to his daughter's death. It's now the fall of 1990. Kimmy has just turned 17. Her birthday is on Halloween. She will be dead just weeks later.
Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.
Dell and I are sitting at one of those wooden picnic tables. His wife and friends are nearby enjoying their morning coffee. The ocean is not far off in the distance. Dell's easy to talk to, and he's eager to share whatever he can. But it doesn't get much harder than surfacing this particular memory. Dell mentions that he and Kimmy are into car racing, and it's through that community that Dell learns his daughter has been murdered.
One of my racing buddies' dad was a sergeant with Victoria City Police. And when they found Kim, they quickly figured out who it was, and they came right to me right from there.
And so what happens then?
Oh, gosh. A bit of a blur there that day. I mean, a couple of good big strapping policemen came to my place of employ and sat me down at the lunchroom table and told me what they thought had gone on and would I come down and do an identification. Tough.
I've spent hours scouring old newspaper articles, searching for any information given by police or firsthand accounts at the time. Here's what I've learned. Between 2 and 3 a.m., early in the morning of November 21st, Kim meets an unidentified male while she's out on the stroll on the 1200 block of Government Street and View, near Trounce Alley. This guy has been observed lurking around the area. He is not someone known to other sex trade workers. The man chooses Kim. A taxi driver takes Kim and the man to the Colony Motor Inn. This motel is no longer there, but back then it was home to a rowdy beer parlor called the Brass Rail, and for a time, a strip club as well. Kim shares a room with other girls. Back then, it would have been referred to as a trick pad. Another motel guest will observe the man leaving the room. Later that morning, one of Kim's friends goes to the room with a new client. And it is there that she will find Kim dead. Dell recalls being picked up in a squad car right at work and taken to the hospital to identify his daughter Kim. He attends the funeral for his daughter, but he and Kim's mom aren't talking much, and he recalls feeling like an outsider. There's no solace for him there. Instead, Dell takes an unusual approach. He hits the streets, the Victoria Stroll, where his daughter Kim was being exploited to sell sex to strangers.
I did go on the streets with a couple of gentlemen. I can't remember their names, honestly. Two big, burly Wall Street cops, you know, and I walked the streets with them, and I did a little bit of time in the squad car with Doug Bond.
Dell wants to do something, anything, that could get him answers and justice for Kim. I need to know more about the Victoria Stroll back then. The Doug Bond Dell mentions is a legendary Victoria police detective who works Kim's case at the time. I've pulled out all the stops trying to speak with him. As far as I can tell, he's retired and still lives in the area. But so far, no luck. In the period after Kim's death, police track down the taxi driver. They speak to motel guests and other witnesses, including Kim's friends. Police release a composite drawing of the client last seen with Kim. He has a thin build and a mustache. He's thought to be about 5'7". And perhaps most notably, he's wearing an expensive dark-colored ski jacket with neon pink diamond border and green on the shoulders. Barb McClintock is reporting on Kim's murder at the time. She understands the importance of detail. McClintock will go on to be a coroner for years here. Back then, the Victoria Police spoke with reporters more freely than they do today. Detective Doug Bond confirms Kim was strangled. And he tells McClintock that he's working closely with the Saanich Police. A teenager named Sherry Lynn Smith has been killed in that jurisdiction earlier in the summer. Bond says there are similarities. He says both girls were strangled, and both were picked up in virtually the same spot. Also, both Sherry and Kimberly worked the Western Canada circuit. On Monday, December 31st, 1990, McClintock publishes a news story, including a significant detail. In it, she once again quotes Detective Sergeant Doug Bond. He says there is forensic evidence linking Kimberly's death to the recent deaths of three Vancouver sex workers. Bond says he believes the killer lives in the Lower Mainland and that they made a trip to Victoria. He also says there are definite links to at least three cases. Now, keep in mind, this is 1990. Early days for computers and the internet. In the relatively small Victoria area, there are 8 police jurisdictions. And now I'm learning the police are also liaising with police on the lower mainland of Vancouver, another area with multiple police authorities. Time passes, days into weeks into months, and Dell doesn't recall any updates on the investigation.
Absolutely nothing. The police kept very quiet. After that, I was pretty much given no information, nothing.
Right. And were you aware at the time that there had been another young woman killed?
No.
No.
I didn't know that.
Right. And subsequently that another young girl was killed. Was that ever...
Nope, no. I did not know until years later. Mm-hmm. But I tried to stay as involved as I could with the police at the time. So Kim was killed 21st of November. Mm-hmm. So December, January, February, and then in March, Michael Dunahy went missing. Mm-hmm. And everything just dropped. It just went flat. It was a flat line right there. Mm-hmm. Get it. I totally understand that, but... That was kind of the end of the whole thing, was Michael Dunahy went missing, and the whole focus of everything in Victoria went there. And after that, I lost communication with the police.
I tell Dell that I first learned of Kim's death in the context of researching the abduction of 4-year-old Michael Dunahy. Kim is killed in November 1990. Michael is taken in March of 1991. From Dell's perspective, the investigation, the public attention, everything just stops when Michael is abducted. And he gets it. On the one hand, you have a dead teenager. On the other hand, you have a child who could still be alive. The next time Dell will hear from the police is when they return Kim's clothing to him.
They brought me all her old clothing and the clothes she was wearing when they found her, or clothes that were there when they found her. And they had all been laundered and folded up neatly and presented to me. I was given those.
And what was the stuff? Like, what was it?
A miniskirt, a top, some really cute boots with 5 or 6 inch heels on them. I think there was a white leather belt, if I remember correctly. That was a long time ago. But it was a blue denim miniskirt, and I believe it was a pink, something a little on the frilly side. Not a T-shirt, but, some, you know, not a collared shirt.
4 years, Dell packs these items around with him. The clothing his daughter Kim was wearing on the evening she was killed. These last physical links to his daughter at the time of her death are packed and unpacked as he changes addresses and moves from city to city. But then, he tells me, he just threw them out. They were nothing but sore memories for him. But today, Dell finds himself wondering...
Gosh, what if there's DNA? You know, what if, you know, what I could do today, but...
He asks himself if there could have been some kind of DNA evidence on his daughter's clothing.
But if nothing happens, I've accepted it. It's 33 years later. I'm moving on, but...
Yeah.
Would be nice to have some closure. No, why? How?
Today... He tells me he doesn't know if DNA evidence exists in his daughter's case.
I have had no contact from any law enforcement agency at all.
This is something I hear frequently from other families involved in cold cases of murdered or missing people. And then Dell wonders aloud if there might be another reason the police don't speak with him.
I could be a suspect. Honestly, I'm the dad. They interviewed me extensively. I'm going to drop another name for you if you're...
Dell puts me in touch with his cousin, Lori. She and Kim were close in age, and he thinks she'll want to talk to me.
I remember Kim as long hair, bright, beautiful eyes, and always smiling.
Lori's keen to talk about Kim.
My name is Lori, and I was Kim's, well, actually Del. Kim's dad is my first cousin. And so our family is quite spread out. So his daughter is actually my age.
Lori is living on the Lower Mainland. Back then, ferries are way less expensive. And she recalls coming over to the island frequently for birthdays and family gatherings.
You know, Kim was always so energetic and bright and sunny, and she was always so much fun to get together with.
I want to know more about what's going on in Kim's life in the years leading up to her death. So I asked Lori, what's it like for Kim after her parents separate?
You know, Kim never let on of things that were bothering her. She always had a happy disposition. And so I know that she wasn't particularly happy in her life, you know, with her parents and everything. I know that she wanted to move out a long time before she ever did. But, you know, Jim would never kind of dwell on that. She just always had a very, I don't know how to explain it, but she always just kind of moved forward.
Not long before Kim's murder, Lori has made the ferry trip over to the island.
She heard that I was going to be at Auntie's house, so she came over and got me and said, come on, let's go for a walk. And so we went to the 7-Eleven, we bought a Slurpee, we sat on a brick wall right near the 7-Eleven, and all her friends from school were there, and she had lots of friends, and she was very outgoing. I guess it was the local hangout, and we just had such a wonderful kind of reunion, and we were 17. It was just prior to her death.
They're just ordinary teenage girls hanging out at the 7-Eleven, drinking Slurpees. Afterwards, Kimberly brings Lori back to her apartment.
She was showing me all these beautiful new clothes that she had bought, and she was just bubbling with energy and so happy.
You're a teenager and you're visiting your cousin. She's living off on her own and she's showing you all these new clothes. What, like, do you have a conversation about, like, how is that happening?
Yeah, I said, oh, where are you working? Do you have a job? And she, I remember her saying, no, I had somebody who takes care of me. And she cut the conversation there. She didn't want to go any further. So I that always stood out to me. And I understood it after she passed away and I found out what she had been doing for work. But yeah, I was very shocked to find that out.
Not long after, Lori remembers her parents breaking the dreadful news to her.
Oh, yeah. My parents called me into the kitchen and sat me down and told me that Kim had passed away and I was in shock. And we were coming over on the ferry for the funeral not long after, and I saw the article in the newspaper on the ferry, and I brought it to my parents and went, what? And they had left that part out. You know, they didn't want to tell me she had been murdered. They didn't want to tell me what she had been doing for a living and all that stuff.
It's only then that Lori thinks back to her time with Kim. Just a month or so before Kim's murder, she thinks about those fancy new clothes. And maybe she did detect some embarrassment from her cousin. Kim also changed the subject quickly when Lori asked about her work. The clues were there.
My next memory really is of her funeral and how many people were there and how her death impacted so many people of our age as well as my age now, you know, in my 50s. I think when you lose someone, especially someone that young, I mean, you know, there is a huge impact. Del, her dad, has kind of adopted me a little bit over the years because I was the same age as Kim.
She also remembers feeling that soon afterwards, the world moves on.
I always felt like it just got swept under the rug. Just another, you know, sex worker murdered. No big deal.
That's the thing with an unsolved murder like Kimberly Gallup's. The cases may go cold from an investigative stance, but the families and friends of the victims don't forget. There's nothing resembling closure, no meaningful way to move on.
It's always been on my mind. Everybody is important, and that's somebody's daughter, somebody's sister, somebody's cousin. You know, you wish you could do something to help bring her killer to justice and stuff, but where to start?
At this point, as I'm learning about Kim from family members and friends, I've yet to speak with Kim's mother, Barb. We exchange a few short emails and have one uncomfortable phone call. I can't even begin to imagine how tough this is, and I let her know if she has a change of heart and wants to talk down the line, that's okay. And then I get this message. After having a bit of time to reflect, as I was very surprised by the attention of her case again after so long, I do think I would like to have a conversation with you. I hope to be more prepared for our discussion and a meaningful conversation with you about Kim.
My name is Barb Gallup. Live in Victoria, have done for many, many, many years, majority of my life, and was born in Victoria as well.
When the family first moves back to the island, they live with Del's parents for a while before finding their own home. But it's not long after that that Barb says they realize they're just not meant to be together. Barb shares some pictures from this time in Kim's life. Skinny young Kim playing soccer in her Adidas. A little kid, bright hair, blowing in the breeze. Another of Kim at Disneyland, wearing shades and driving a bumper car. As Kim moves through adolescence and in her early teen years, Barb recalls her daughter as bright and interested in a wide variety of activities.
Well, she loved reading Nancy Drew books and stuff. She loved her music. She was a huge Bon Jovi fan. She liked car racing. She liked, she was a Kansas City Chiefs fan. She, you know, she was involved in lots of different things. And I can't really explain what happened to change things.
I find myself thinking Kim and I would have gotten along. Unsurprisingly, I too was a big Nancy Drew fan. It's not until the summer before her 16th birthday that things begin to go off the rails. More than 30 years on, Barb still struggles to understand what happened.
She didn't want to pay attention to rules here, and she was going to go live with her father, and life would be better over there than what it was. So, which is quite understandable and typical for somebody that's 15 or 16 years of age, I guess.
Kim's dad, Del, has a new partner at the time. His partner has teenage daughters. But as you've heard earlier from Del, Kim isn't able to live with him either, and staying with her grandparents also fails to work out for Kim. Barb tells me she didn't have much contact with her daughter during this period. The last time she sees Kim is when her daughter turns 17.
We just met. We were going to meet for, actually, it was her birthday. We were going to meet for lunch, but she showed up with some other friends. And I mean, it wasn't anything I wanted. I was trying to get her to, you know, take a look at her life. No, she wasn't interested. She had friends. She was having a good time. And obviously, she was not in the headspace she should have been. And it wasn't last very long. It was, oh, okay, fine. Thanks. Nice to see you. Goodbye.
3 weeks later, a man Barb once went to school with arrives at her home.
The police knocking on the door to tell me.
Imagine that moment from Barb's perspective. She's in her home. She goes to the door and sees a man she's known since her own teenage years, Sergeant Doug Bond, now a police officer, there to deliver the very worst news a mom can hear.
Well, it's absolutely devastating and heartbreaking.
To this day, Kim's murder devastates her mom and her large extended family.
She had a lot of people, still has a lot of people in this world who adore her and love her and miss her very, very much. But we cannot bring her back, so the best we can do is try and keep her memory alive, keep our memories of her as happy as we can, and remember all the wonderful times we had. And we had fabulous times, and those are what we hold on to. My parents have both gone now, but it was extremely hard for them as well. I mean, she's the only one in the family that we have ever had such a tragic loss of, and it has affected all of us a lot. Nothing is going to help, and nothing is probably ever going to get closure, but it would give Whitby some solace if they did find the person who actually was responsible for it. But, and the bottom line is, it's not bringing her back, and it's not allowing her to have the life that she deserved and that she should have had.
Kim's dad, Del, has resigned himself to the possibility he may never know who killed his daughter. But he tells me he sure would like to know, and...
I would just like to erase the prostitute thing. Just a young lady that, that didn't make it.
Del clings to treasured memories of Kimmy.
Just things she made me when she was in school, right. When she was little, yeah.
Like what?
Oh, God, I got this ugly ashtray. And a ladybug. She made me a ladybug with, I don't know, out of an egg carton with a little pipe cleaner antenna. Those are in my cabinet.
Kim's father sends me pictures of these mementos. The little ladybug breaks my heart. I picture young Kim, curling the red pipe cleaners to make the antenna, carefully painting the black spots on the ladybird's back. I've learned that just months before Kim is killed, another teenage girl's body is found.
September the 11th, 1990, I still remember the day very clearly. A Regina City police officer came to our door, and Sherry was a missing person. And he came and said, "Mr. Smith, I have news about Sherry." But it was not the news we wanted to hear. He told us that a man riding horseback outside of Victoria had discovered the remains of a female body, and that was the body of our daughter, Sherry.
I'll shed light on the troubling story of Sherry Lynn Smith in episode 2, After the Fair. I'm Laura Palmer, and this is Sweethearts, Island Crime, Season 6. If you or someone you know may be a human trafficking victim, call the Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline at 1-833-900-1010. The hotline is a confidential, multilingual service. It operates 24/7 to connect victims and survivors with social services, law enforcement, and emergency services. It also receives tips from the public.